Now, I'm going to give you a rundown of what it is that we're going to be hearing on tonight's program. First of all, we're going to begin by... Now, by the way, tonight is going to be another installment in Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection, Part 3. I'm going to begin by reading an article from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, January 25th of 1993. This will not only go, as so many of the installments of RFA 38 have been so far, this is not only going to go into the archives as part of RFA 38, but as an addendum to Radio Free America number 21, the fifth and concluding broadcast in a five-part Radio Free America series dealing with the shooting of Pope John Paul II. This particular article, written ironically enough by Hugh Pope of the Los Angeles Times, deals with an assassination, not an attempted assassination, but a real and successful assassination. And unfortunately, the victim is a fellow named Ugur Mumcu, who was the top Turkish, a Turkish journalist, who was the top Turkish expert on counterterrorism, and an individual who had exposed, among other things, the connections of the Central Intelligence Agency and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations to the Turkish Grey Wolves in the National Action Party. Of course, a member of that Turkish fascist political party, Mehmet Ali Agha, shot Pope John Paul II. He is described in this article as having publicized the Bulgarian link to the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II. As far as I know, and I'm not familiar with the career of Ugur Mumcu past a point, as far as I know, this is disinformation. I do know that Ugur Mumcu disclosed that at the time that Mehmet Ali Agha pulled the trigger on the Pope, the National Action Party, of which the Grey Wolves is the youth wing, was indeed very close to the Central Intelligence Agency. Whether or not that particular expose had anything to do with the assassination of Ugur Mumcu is anybody's guess, but at the very least, his death, his assassination, is a loss for the world journalistic community. It is a loss for the world's anti-fascist community, and it does raise some interesting questions. That particular article is by way of kicking off an introduction into the continued discussion, the development of the discussion of the U.S. National Security Establishment's counterterrorism infrastructure. We, a couple of weeks ago, took a look at George Bush, then a candidate for President of the United States, at George Bush's attendance at a counterterrorism conference in Jerusalem in July of 1979. That particular conference sounded the tone for much of the Cold War propaganda in the 1980s concerning terrorism and terrorism as the exclusive product of Soviet agitation. That was a major propaganda theme of the Cold War in the 1980s, one of the things which incidentally underlay the propaganda concerning the so-called Bulgarian connection to the shooting of the Pope. And it's going to be the jumping off point. I'm going to reiterate part of what I read a couple of weeks ago, and it's going to be a jumping off point for a discussion of a very, very important article in Covert Action Information Bulletin number 33. This article is about the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, and it is written, it was authored by the brilliant Professor Peter Dale Scott from the University of California at Berkeley, an individual who merits serious consideration as the foremost political consciousness in the United States today. This is a characteristically brilliant Scott effort, and it deals with the evolution of the counter-terrorist infrastructures within our national security establishment. They have evolved into a standing infrastructure which has been used in the past and could be used in the present or future to completely bypass all elements of political democracy in the United States. Most notably, the counter-terrorist infrastructure ultimately could lead to the summary implementation of any one of a number of drastic measures in response to any one of a number of supposedly, quote, unforeseen, unquote, events. And indeed, the implications of the counter-terrorist infrastructure that has been put together within our national security establishment go far beyond the implications of terrorism slash counter-terrorism themselves. And indeed, ultimately, the counter-terrorist infrastructure and the crisis management infrastructure that has been assembled within the U.S. national security establishment over the past couple of decades could very easily lead to the implementation of martial law in the event of any one of a number of catastrophes, not just a terrorist incident, but an economic or ecological or political catastrophe. And that ultimately is where we're going to be going with our examination of The Terror Connection, Part 3. After examining this brilliant and very important article by Peter Dale Scott, we're going to take a look at some information from a new book called The Prophets of War by Ari Ben-Menashe. Ben-Menashe is a former, and perhaps that term belongs in quotes, a former Israeli intelligence operative, and we're going to be taking a look at Ari Ben-Menashe's description of the development of the Promise software. That software, of course, figures at the core of the Inslaw case, and for those of you not familiar with the Inslaw case, it's a major national security scandal with evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of a number of other national security scandals, including the October surprise, the Iran-Contra scandal, and others. We're going to be taking a look at Ari Ben-Menashe's account of the development of the Promise software and Ben-Menashe's allegations concerning the role of Rafi Eitan, E-I-T-A-N, an Israeli intelligencer and counterterrorist specialist who, at least according to Ben-Menashe, was deeply involved in the development of the Promise software, and in particular the altered Promise software, which permitted the U.S. intelligence apparatus to access the files of other friendly and hostile intelligence services. This particular account of the development of the Promise software, which has elements which intersect with other accounts of the Promise software, it also has information which, at least to this observer, is new. I'm not endorsing or decrying the information. Some of it may be inaccurate. Some of it undoubtedly is accurate. But the development of the Promise software, according to Ben-Menashe's account, was initially in response to, quote, counter-terrorism, or not in response to, but it was initially developed as a counter-terrorist measure. And this particular account is presented here by way of looking ahead, looking to the future, and anticipating the development of the ongoing discussion from Radio Free America number 38 concerning counter-terrorism. Because as I've said, where we're ultimately going is way beyond the issue of terrorism and counterterrorism itself or themselves, and we are going to be taking a look at a standing infrastructure within not only our national security establishment, but within those of other national security establishments, which could be used to implement for the formal implementation of overt German-style fascism in response to an unforeseen emergency, be it political, economic, or ecological. That is what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back with the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. There's a possibility, too, we may be visiting with Virginia McCullough for a period of time, a researcher who's been working with us for some time. I don't know, but we will find that out a little later. I've had a tough time raising Virginia this evening. Anyway, that's what we have on tap for this evening. After a musical break, we're going to come back with the main body of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. It's time now for the prepared portion of One Step Beyond, and we're going to begin by reading an article or examining an article which will serve as an addendum to Radio Free America 21 and is also, obviously, part of this installment of Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection, Part 3. The following article is from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, January 25th of 1993. This article is by Hugh Pope, P-O-P-E, of the Los Angeles Times, sort of an ironic choice, well, not a choice, but an ironic name in light of the subject material. It's datelined Istanbul, Turkey, and headlined, Car Bomb Kills Turkish Foe of Extremists. It reads in part as follows. A car bomb killed one of Turkey's best-known newspaper columnists Sunday, plunging the country into shock at the death of a tireless campaigner against Islamic extremism and anything else he believed was damaging the 70-year-old secular republic. Several Islamic groups claimed responsibility for the murder of Ugur Mumcu, U-G-U-R-M-U-M-C-U, 50, who died instantly when a bomb that had been planted under his car exploded as he started the automobile outside his apartment in Ankara, Turkey's capital. Turkey's state television news hinted at what many openly suspect, that responsibility for the killing may be linked to Iran's Islamic revolutionary radicals, despite a recent improvement in official relations between Ankara and Tehran. Quote, fighting desperately for their dark hopes in First President Kemal Ataturk's enlightened Turkey, forces controlled from outside chose Ugur Mumcu, unquote, said an announcer. Mumcu's left-wing Cumhuriyet newspaper said the most likely suspect group was the Islamic Salvation Organization, whose spokesman called the paper immediately after the blast to say that Mumcu, quote, had been punished, unquote. Skipping down in the article, by the way, Cumhuriyet is C-U-M-H-U-R-I-Y-E-T. Skipping down, Mungchu was working on a book about links between Kurdish separatists and the Turkish National Intelligence Agency. His colleagues said that he had made many enemies with his no-holds-barred reporting. As a journalist, he was well known for publicizing the Bulgarian link and the attempted assassination in 1981 of Pope John Paul II by a Turk, Mehmet Ali Agca. I would interject, I would take that last sentence with a grain of salt for reasons I'll explain in a minute. In controversial, meticulously researched articles in at least 13 books, he constantly campaigned against Kurdish extremism, drug mafias, official corruption, the activities of foreign spy agencies, note that last one, the activities of foreign spy agencies, Turkey's relationship with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and Turkish police methods. Well, the name Uğur Mumcu is one quite well known to veteran listeners to this broadcast. It was Uğur Mumcu in an article revealed in an article that was carried in the Arizona Republic from February of 1982, who disclosed that not only did the Central Intelligence Agency have operating links to the National Action Party, the Turkish fascist political party of which the Grey Wolves is the youth wing, but the operational links between the CIA and the National Action Party and Grey Wolves go back to the late 60s and 70s, when the Grey Wolves were cultivated by the CIA as an anti-communist, as anti-communist activists and enforcers. But also, Uğur Mumcu disclosed that at the time that Mehmet Ali Agca, a member of the Turkish Grey Wolves, along with other members of the Grey Wolves, including Oral Çelik, a.k.a. Avni Yasser Musululu, a key player not only in the Pizza Connection cases, but also in the Şikarki AG case, a gold and drug smuggling operation with strong links to the Iran-Contra scandal, but at the time, Mehmet Ali Agca shot Pope John Paul II, the Grey Wolves had very strong connections to the Central Intelligence Agency, and specifically a fellow named Ruzi Nazar, R-U-Z-Y-N-A-Z-A-R, was serving as a liaison between the CIA and the Turkish Grey Wolves, and that the CIA was very well informed on what was going on with the Grey Wolves. Ruzi Nazar, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 21, had been a member of an SS punishment battalion during World War II. He was originally a Soviet citizen of Turkish extraction. He was captured by the Germans in World War II, then turned to the German cause, became a member of the Waffen-SS, and after the war, he became a key functionary of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. That was an organization that was put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943, and it became a key element of what later was to become the World Anti-Communist League. In fact, Ruzi Nazar, liaison, as described by Mumcu, between CIA and the National Action Party, was in fact one of the two representatives of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations to the World Anti-Communist League's conference in Dallas, Texas, in 1985. Incidentally, the other ABN representative was Slava Stetsko, the then wife, now widow, of Yaroslav Stetsko, a key member of the OUN, the Ukrainian separatist and fascist organization, of which the best-known member was Stefan Bandera. And it should be noted again that one of the more preposterous aspects of the Bulgarian thesis, now discredited in just about every place but the United States, was that Mehmet Ali Agca, in addition to having been trafficked around, quite obviously, his miraculous escapes from prisons, his miraculous, and the miraculous here is to be taken sarcastically, his miraculous ability to cross borders despite being a wanted man, wanted for, among other things, for the assassination of Abdi Aypeki, a very important Turkish editor, Mehmet Ali Agca, far from being a Soviet functionary, was a member of, as I said, the Grey Wolves, the youth wing of the National Action Party, an explicitly fascist political party with links going all the way back to the Third Reich. Turkey, of course, is a NATO country, and Alparslan Türkeş, the founder of the National Action Party, was a key representative of Turkey to NATO, and in particular had worked as a liaison person between NATO, between Turkey, I should say, and the United States within the NATO superstructure. And the notion of a member of a fascist political party from a NATO country being a Soviet functionary, while not impossible, is rather far-fetched. In fact, as we looked at in exhaustive detail in Radio Free America shows 17 through 21 dealing with the shooting of the Pope, The available evidence points very strongly in the direction of Western intelligence agencies as having been behind the shooting of Pope John Paul II. That particular crime was a major propaganda football during the 1980s and was used in a big, big way in this country and elsewhere to underscore the Cold War propaganda theme of international terrorism as being the creature of the Soviet Union. The former Soviet Union certainly was behind some of the international terrorism in the world, but most of it was either independently generated or generated in considerable measure by Western intelligence agencies in order to serve as what is known as a provocation, an incident staged in order to justify a preordained response, either a domestic crackdown or military adventurism abroad. The available evidence in the shooting of Pope John Paul II points in the direction of elements such as the World Anti-Communist League, elements of the BND, elements associated with the P2 Lodge, the Propaganda Douay Lodge in Italy, and the CIA as having been involved with the shooting of Pope John Paul II. It should be noted that a number of elements that were associated with the Triple Wilson operation in the 1970s, that operation initiated by U.S. intelligence under the auspices of then-CIA Director George Bush, that particular operation was involved with training, or involved, I should say, training and arming many of the world's most notorious terrorist groups, including the Grey Wolves. None other than Frank Turpel boasted in a BBC documentary of having trained the Grey Wolves, and the former Green Beret, a fellow named, what was his name? William Russell Cranford. Okay, a Green Beret who I guess was a native of North Carolina. He was the individual who, according to prosecutor Lawrence Barcella, who convicted Edwin Wilson, was involved with the training of the Grey Wolves. He was never, that is to say, William Russell Cranford was never able to try to testify because he was found dead, supposedly a suicide, although it was a rather strange suicide. There were two bullets in Cranford's head, supposedly from a revolver, and that's a difficult thing to do. It should be noted that in addition to the Grey Wolves, the Triple Wilson operation was involved with the training and arming of Gaddafi's terrorist cadre, the Red Brigades of Italy, the Japanese Red Army faction, the Baader-Meinhof gang, and elements of the IRA as well. The P2 Lodge and elements associated with it, as well as the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring, a massive arms for drugs ring based in Italy and with strongly intersecting with U.S. intelligence, were among the other elements that figure in the shooting of Pope John Paul II. Western intelligence connections are documented to the shooting of the Pope, that is, are documented in Radio Free America number 21. And the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring, deeply involved with U.S. intelligence, is discussed in Radio Free America number 20. It remains to be seen exactly who killed Ugur Mumcu and why. I would note in this regard a conversation that I had over a couple of weeks with Farah Mansour, a brilliant researcher and member of the Iranian resistance, who has developed some very compelling research pointing in the direction of a long-standing pattern of cooperation between U.S. intelligence and the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Iran in order to groom the Islamic fundamentalists as a vehemently anti-communist successor to the Shah of Iran. We'll be visiting, by the way, with Farah Mansour. There's some interesting reactions to the research that he has done. We'll be talking about those in weeks to come. It should be noted, though, again, that there are, apparently, according to a number of sources, including and especially Farah Mansour, links between our intelligence system and elements of the Islamic fundamentalist movement abroad. Obviously, the Iran-Contra scandal disclosed some of those links. Equally obviously, the U.S. and the Islamic fundamentalist guerrillas in Afghanistan have a long-standing pattern of cooperation. So the notion of a possible, note the use of the term possible, U.S. connection to the assassination of Ugur Mumcu is one that I would not rule out under the circumstances. I would note, too, that a longtime U.S. Cold War functionary and apparent intelligence operative, Alan Weinstein of the National Endowment for Democracy, is currently attempting to dredge up the now discredited Bulgarian thesis by way of putting some Cold War cement on that particular canard. Stay tuned for Bulgarian Connection 2, courtesy of Alan Weinstein. Again, I refer people to Archives on Audio for a long discussion of the shooting of the Pope. Radio Free America shows 17 through 21, and a subsequent information developed in the Operation Gladio, the Fascist Third Position Miscellaneous Archive shows, as well as in Radio Free America shows 32, 34 and 35. All of those contain information supplementing the original RFA 17 through 21 series. Now, during the course of Radio Free America number 38, we have been examining once again one of the major themes of these broadcasts over the years, or one of the major focal points, namely the long-standing pattern of cooperation between some elements of our intelligence system, unfortunately dominant elements, and many of the very international terrorists that we are told we are opposed to and must protect ourselves against. As I've indicated, there are many different motivations for this cooperation at various different levels, ranging from the use of terrorism as a provocation, as a justification for expanded police and surveillance powers at home, reduced civil liberties, as well as a justification for military adventurism abroad. It should be noted, too, that that cooperating with terrorists can be used to exert pressure on countries whose economies are dependent upon tourism. It can be used to assassinate troublesome individuals. It can be used to prevent the assassination of people who are deemed necessary to our interests. It also can be used to help bolster the coffers of our intelligence system through drug trafficking and weapons trafficking, all of them inextricably linked with the terrorist milieu. In Radio Free America 38, what we are going to be examining above all is the evolution of the U.S. and the U.S. national security establishment's counter-terrorist infrastructure. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the seminal role of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, the Vice President in question being a former CIA Director George Bush, who was Director of the Central Intelligence Agency when the Turple Wilson operation was undertaken. Many of the people involved with the Turple Wilson operation later cropped up in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, including Theodore Shackley, who went to Italy in February of 1981 and began working with Italian intelligencers associated with the P2. This at a time when the Vatican and the Kremlin were working out a diplomatic rapprochement among on a number of different things, including the toning down of the heightened tensions in Poland over the Cold War and the Solidarity Trade Union, as well as recognizing the PLO. The latter, of course, something which would be anathema to the Israelis, and it should be noted that the Israelis and the Israeli intelligence system and the U.S. intelligence system were very, very closely, they had a pattern of very close cooperation, not only in the Iran-Contra scandal proper, but specifically were coordinating their counter-terrorist activities and infrastructures in the 1970s and 80s. What we're going to do this evening is take a look at the evolution of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, and we're going to take a look at the U.S. National Security Establishment's counter-terrorist infrastructure, and specifically we are going to take a look at the institutions which grew out of directives coming out of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism, and we're going to take a look at how the national security infrastructures utilized by Oliver North and company, the infrastructures used by Oliver North and company in the Iran-Contra scandal grew out of the Vice President's Task Force, and we're going to take a look at how the infrastructures so created are not only in place today, but have been used in the past and could be used in the future to completely bypass the normal democratic procedures. Certainly that was done in the Iran-Contra scandal when congressional legislation was illegally bypassed and with impunity for all intents and purposes. More significantly in the future, the infrastructures which grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism and which are in place to this day could be used ultimately to implement martial law in response to an unforeseen crisis. Unforeseen here belongs in quotes. I'm going to begin the discussion by reviewing a section of an article that we read a couple of weeks ago. This particular article is from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 33. This issue is entitled, by the way, George Bush, the Company's Man, and this particular article is called The 1980 Campaign, Agents for Bush, by Bob Callahan. And after reading a section documenting the very significant involvement of the intelligence community with George Bush's attempt to challenge Ronald Reagan for the 1980 Republican nomination, We examined the attendance of George Bush and some of his intelligence cohorts, including Ray Klein, a very prominent backer of Bush for president in 1980. We examined their attendance at a very important, one might say, seminal conference on combating terrorism. This was held in July of 1979 in Jerusalem. I would note that the significance of this particular conference was that it created for the first time, or it put on display for the first time, that would be a better way of putting it, one of the most important propaganda themes of the Cold War, namely, at least the Cold War of the 1980s, namely, international terrorism as the exclusive creature of the former Soviet Union. Obviously, as I indicated, one of the major propaganda footballs of the 1980s in the Cold War was the notion that the KGB, using their Bulgarian surrogates, shot Pope John Paul II. The available evidence suggests, in fact, that that event was a provocation created by Western intelligence agencies specifically in order to defame the Soviet Union and to inflame Cold War sentiments at home. I would note again that the theme of international terrorism as a creature of the Soviets first gained prominence from this conference on combating terrorism in July of 1979. Note again that the Israelis and the U.S. very closely cooperated in this particular Cold War operation, and that both had a lot to gain. The U.S., obviously, by painting the Soviets as the authors of international terrorism, stood to gain from a propaganda standpoint. The Soviets were then tarred with that particular brush. And the Israelis also stood to gain from this particular viewpoint, because the Israelis obviously were and are bitter opponents of the PLO. And the PLO, with its very close operational links to the Soviet Union, could be portrayed as the creature of the Soviet Union and one of the major players on the international terrorist stage. The PLO officially, or at least Yasser Arafat, officially repudiated terrorism as a means of affecting Palestinian liberation, although many elements of the PLO continued and continue to be involved in international terrorism. I would note that the Palestinian elements most involved with international terrorism at this point not only aren't Soviet surrogates, of course the Soviet Union no longer exists, but in fact many of those same elements, such as Manzer al-Qassar, such as George Habash, those elements are in fact deeply connected to Western intelligence, not the Soviet Union. By way of kicking off tonight's discussion, let's review this particular section of Bob Callahan's article, Agents for Bush. In a section called Bush and Counterterrorism, which will set the stage for much of tonight's discussion, we find the following. Callahan writes, once again, this is from Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 33, from the winter of 1990. The Bush presidential campaign not only set the tone for the role and structure of the intelligence apparatus in the new Reagan administration, it also took up a new foreign policy theme which would reap huge political dividends in the years to come. That last sentence again, I sort of blew it. The Bush presidential campaign not only set the tone for the role and structure of the intelligence apparatus in the new Reagan administration, it also took up a new foreign policy theme which would reap huge political dividends in the years to come. This new theme was terrorism slash counterterrorism. In July of 1979, George Bush and Ray Klein attended a conference in Jerusalem where this theme was given its first significant political discussion before leaders of Israel, Great Britain, and the United States. It would take an enormously important event to keep a major American presidential candidate away from the campaign on the 4th of July weekend. For George Bush, the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism was such an event. The Jerusalem Conference was hosted by the Israeli government, and not surprisingly, most of Israel's top intelligence officers and leading political leaders were in attendance. Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin rose to the podium on July 2, 1979, to provide the conference with its opening address. By the summer of 1979, even Menachem Begin was willing to join in the bashing of his old Camp David friend, Jimmy Carter, a practice which had become almost endemic by the fall of 1979. The Israelis were angry with Carter because his administration had recently released its annual report on human rights, wherein the Israeli government was taken to task for abusing the rights of the Palestinian people on the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israel's new anti-Carter tone was mild, however, compared to the rhetoric of the two separate U.S. delegations which attended the conference. The first delegation was led by the late Senator Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington. It included the noted black civil rights leader Bayard Rustin, Ben Wattenberg of the American Enterprise Institute, and Norman Podoritz and Midge Dechter of Commentary magazine. The members of this delegation were registered Democrats, yet all became very active in neoconservative politics during the Reagan years. The Republican delegation was led by George Bush. It included Ray Klein and two important members of Team B, of Bush's Team B from his CIA days, Major General George Keegan, a Bush supporter who had served as intelligence chief for the United States Air Force, and Harvard professor Richard Pipes. Looking for a mobilizing issue to counter the Carter-era themes of détente and human rights, the Bush people began to explore the political benefits of embracing the terrorism-counterterrorism theme. As Jonathan Marshall of the Oakland Tribune explains, quote, "At the conference, Ray Klein developed the theme that terror was not a random response of frustrated minorities, but rather a preferred instrument of East Bloc policy adopted after 1969, when the KGB persuaded the Politburo of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to accept the PLO as a major political instrument in the Mideast and to subsidize its terrorist policies by freely giving money, training, arms, and coordinated communications," unquote. In Ray Klein's imagination, terrorism had now hardened into a system, an international troublemaking system. Richard Pipes elaborated on the Klein hypothesis, quote, "The roots of Soviet terrorism, indeed of modern terrorism," unquote, Pipes stated, again quoting, "date back to 1879. It marks the beginning of that organization which is the source of all modern terrorist groups, whether they be named the Tupamaros, the Baader-Meinhof Group, the Weathermen, Red Brigade, or PLO. I refer to the establishment in 1879 of a congress in the small Russian town of Lipesk, L-I-P-E-S-K, of an organization known as Narodnaya Volya, or the People's Will." By the way, that's N-A-R-O-D-N-A-Y-A-V-O-L-Y-A. According to Philip Paul, P-A-U-L-L, who wrote his master's thesis on the subject of the Jerusalem Conference, quote, "If Pipes was to be believed, the Russians not only support international terrorism, they invented it," unquote. The Bush-Klein-Pipes definition of terrorism was, of course, both expeditious and powerfully political. Quote, "Left out of their equation," unquote, Jonathan Marshall comments, again quoting, "was any mention of terrorist acts by CIA-trained Cuban exiles, Israeli ties to Red Brigades, or the function of death squads from Argentina to Guatemala. Soviet sponsorship, real or imagined, had become the defining characteristic of terrorism, not simply an explanation for its prevalence. Moreover, there was no inclination whatsoever to include under the rubric of terror bombings of civilians or any other acts carried out by government forces rather than small individual units," unquote. Within days after the conference, the new propaganda war began in earnest. On July 11, 1979, the International Herald Tribune featured a lead editorial entitled, quote, "The Issue is Terrorism," unquote, which quoted directly from conference speeches. The same day, Congressman Jack Kemp placed selected quotes from the conference in the Congressional Record. In his syndicated column of July 28, 1979, former CIA employee William F. Buckley blasted two of his favorite targets in one single mixed metaphor. Quote, "No venture is too small to escape the patronage of the by the Soviet Union," beginning again, quote, "No venture is too small to escape patronage by the Soviet Union," unquote, Buckley stated, again quoting, "which scatters funds about for terrorists like HEW in search of welfare clients," unquote. Then in August, George Will, who also attended the conference, wrote about it in the Washington Post. Before the year was out, Commentary, National Review, and eventually New Republic writers would all churn out yard after yard of copy on this theme. Soon after, Claire Sterling, who had also attended the conference, would create the first, quote, Bible, unquote, of this new perspective with the publication of her highly controversial book, The Terror Network. With the help of George Bush and Ray Klein, the Jerusalem Conference had managed to start a propaganda firestorm. In the following decade, the theme of terrorism, counterterrorism, would grow increasingly important to George Bush. He would become the ranking authority on this subject in the Reagan White House. Indeed, it would be Bush's own task force, the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, which would eventually provide Oliver North back-channel authorization through which he would bypass certain dissenting administration officials in his ongoing management of the Reagan-Bush secret war against Nicaragua. Last few sentences again, because these really are the theme of this segment of tonight's RFA 38. With the help of George Bush and Ray Klein, the Jerusalem Conference had managed to start a propaganda firestorm. In the following decade, the theme of terrorism slash counterterrorism would grow increasingly important to George Bush. He would become the ranking authority on this subject in the Reagan White House. Indeed, it would be Bush's own task force, the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, which would eventually provide Oliver North back-channel authorization through which he would bypass certain dissenting administration officials in his ongoing management of the Reagan-Bush secret war against Nicaragua. And indeed, note again that it was the Jerusalem Task Force, the Jerusalem Conference, which sounded the theme, a major propaganda theme, for the 1980s of international terrorism as the creature of the Soviet Union. And beyond that, it established a very important operational aspect of the Cold War and of intelligence operations in the 1980s, namely the very close and ongoing cooperation between Israel and the United States vis-a-vis terrorism slash counterterrorism, and the two are in fact very closely intertwined. In fact, the distinction between terrorism and counterterrorism is often an academic one. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back, and we are going to take a look at the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism, and we're going to take a look in so doing at a very important article by University of California at Berkeley Professor Peter Dale Scott. A little music, and then the Vice President's Task Force, the Vice President in question, being George Bush. We're going to proceed now with this installment of Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection, Part 3. Bearing in mind now the last section of that article from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 33 by Bob Callahan, talking about the attendance of George Bush and fellow intelligencer Ray Klein at the Jerusalem Conference of 1979, at which not only was the 1980s Cold War propaganda theme of terrorism as the creature of the Soviet Union coined, I guess one could say, if not coined, most widely publicized, but the pattern of U.S. and Israeli cooperation vis-a-vis counterterrorism, that pattern was, if not established, certainly deepened at that particular conference. It was a seminal event, and bear in mind also that George Bush was the former director of the CIA, and that while director of the CIA, well, I should say while it was while Bush was director of the CIA, that the Triple Wilson operation, featuring, among others, Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, later, of course, a feature that involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, that the Triple Wilson, it was while Bush was CIA director, that the Triple Wilson operation involved with arming and training many of the world's most notorious terrorist groups. That operation was undertaken while Bush was CIA director. We're going to turn next to a very, very important article from the same issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, namely CAIB number 33 from the winter of 1990. This article is by the brilliant Berkeley researcher, Professor Peter Dale Scott, of the University of California at Berkeley. It's entitled Bush and North, The Task Force on Combating Terrorism. This is a characteristically excellent piece of work by Peter Dale Scott, and in many ways it represents the center, it is the centerpiece of the discussion in Radio Free America number 38, namely pointing to the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism as a seminal institution, an institution which gave rise to the national security infrastructures which were utilized by Oliver North to bypass the normal democratic procedures with his conduct of the covert operations involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. Note also that the infrastructures utilized by Oliver North, which obviously were used to bypass congressional legislation, they were used to bypass the law of the land, that these infrastructures go way beyond anything having directly to do with terrorism or counterterrorism, and that ultimately they have given rise to institutions which could, in the event of a quote, unforeseen, unquote, emergency, be used to eliminate all vestiges of democracy in the United States. In this regard, again, counterterrorism here is being viewed as something which has evolved way past the point of terror of counterterrorism per se. And indeed, in certain respects at least, some of the vestiges of the U.S. national security establishment's counterterrorist infrastructure could in the future be used to establish totalitarian government in the United States in a manner, in certain respects at least, similar to the way the Reichstag incident was utilized by the Nazis in the Third Reich. Recall that the Reichstag, the German parliament building, was burned supposedly by the communists and a poor fellow named Martinus von der Lubbe, a legally blind and legally insane former member of the Dutch Communist Party, was fingered for the crime and then executed before he really had a chance, well, not before, but executed for the crime. The available evidence suggests very strongly that the Nazis themselves were behind this incident. It was utilized by Hitler and company to suspend the German constitution, to implement emergency measures, which then formed the basis for the Nazi dictatorship. I'm not suggesting that this is in any way a perfect analogy, but I think it is an important one. And again, the infrastructures that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism are with us today, and they have been used in the past, notably by Oliver North, to bypass the machinery of American democracy. They could be used in the future to completely eliminate that machinery in the event, once again, of, unquote, unforeseen, unquote, emergency.